Again, I'm not leaving until I find a proper replacement. It's why I asked you to meet me. I need time. It was true, partially at least. Just as he had for the past few nights, Kael had dropped by Adian's party. Another tavern, even more expensive, even more packed. Adian wasn't there again. Somehow, everyone thought the general was there, and even the courtesan who'd left with him the first night said that the general had given her a gold coin. Without utilizing her services, and gone off to find more sparkling wine. Kael had stood on the street corner where the courtesan said she'd left him, but found nothing. And wasn't it fascinating that no one really seemed to know exactly when the Bane would arrive, or where they were currently camped? Only that they were on their way. Kael was too busy during the day to track Adian down, and during the king's various meetings and luncheons, confronting the general was impossible. But tonight, he planned to arrive at the party early enough that he'd see if Adian even showed, and where he slipped off to. The sooner he could get something on Adian, the sooner he could settle all this nonsense and keep the king from looking too long in his direction before he turned in his resignation. He'd only called this meeting because of a thought that had awoken him in the middle of the night. A slightly insane, highly dangerous plan that would likely get him killed before it even accomplished anything. He'd skimmed through all those books Selena had found on magic, and found nothing at all about how he might help Dorian, and Selena, by freeing it. But Selena had once told him that the rebel group Archer and Nehemia had run claimed two things. One, that they knew where Aelin Galathinius was. And two, that they were close to finding a way to break the King of Otterland's mysterious power over the continent. The first one was a lie, of course. But if there was the slightest chance that these rebels knew how to free magic, he had to take it. He was already going out to trail Adian, and he'd seen all of Selena's notes about the rebel hideouts. So he had an idea of where they could be found. This would have to be dealt with carefully, and he still needed as much time as he could buy. His father's dead smile faded, and true steel, honed by decades of ruling N.E.L., shone through. Rumor has it you consider yourself a man of honor, though I wonder what manner of man you truly are, if you do not honor your bargains. I wonder. His father made a good show of chewing on his bottom lip. I wonder what your motive was, then, in sending your woman to Wendlin. Kael fought the urge to stiffen. For the noble Captain Westfall, there would be no question that he truly wanted His Majesty's champion to dispatch our foreign enemies. Yet for the oathbreaker, the liar. I am not breaking my vow to you, Kael said, meaning every word. I intend to go to Enyo. I will swear that in any temple before any god. But only when I've found a replacement. You swore a month, his father growled. You're to have me for the rest of my damned life. What is a month or two more to you? His father's nostrils flared. What purpose, then, did his father have in wanting him to return so quickly? Kael was about to ask, itching to make his father squirm a bit, when an envelope landed on his desk. It had been years, years and years, but he still remembered his mother's handwriting, still recalled the elegant way in which she drew his name.
What is this? Your mother sent a letter to you. I suppose she's expressing her joy at your anticipated return.
Kael didn't touch the envelope.
Aren't you going to read it? I have nothing to say to her, and no interest in what she has to say to me.
Kael lied. Another trap, another way to unnerve him. But he had so much to do here, so many things to learn and uncover. He'd honor his vow soon enough. His father snatched back the letter, tucking it into his tunic.
She will be most saddened to hear that.
And he knew his father, well aware of Kaol's lie, would tell his mother exactly what he'd said. For a heartbeat, his blood roared in his ears, the way it always had when he'd witnessed his father belittling his mother, reprimanding her, ignoring her. He took a steadying breath.
4 months, then I'll go. Set the date and it'll be done. 2 months. 3.
A slow smile.
I could go to the king right now and ask for your dismissal instead of waiting 3 months.
Kaol clenched his jaw.
Name your price, then. Oh, there's no price. But I think I like the idea of you owing me a favor.
That dead smile returned.
I like that idea very much. 2 months, boy.
They did not bother with goodbyes. Sorsha was called up to the Crown Prince's chambers, just as she was settling in to brew a calming tonic for an overworked kitchen girl. And though she tried not to seem too eager and pathetic, she found a way to very, very quickly dump the task on one of the lower-level apprentices and make the trek to the prince's tower. She'd never been here, but she knew where it was. All the healers did, just in case. The guards let her pass with hardly a nod, and by the time she descended the spiral staircase, the door to his chambers was already open. A mess. His rooms were a mess of books and papers and discarded weapons. And there, sitting at a table with hardly a foot of space cleared for him, was Dorian, looking rather embarrassed, either at the mess or at his split lip. She managed to bow, even as that traitorous heat flooded her again, up her neck and across her face.
Your Highness summoned me.
A cleared throat.
Well, I think you can see what needs repairing.
Another injury to his hand. This one looked like it was from sparring. But the lip. Getting that close to him would be an effort of will. Hand first, then. Let that distract her. Anchor her. She set down her basket of supplies and lost herself in the work of readying ointments and bandages. His scented soap caressed her nose, strong enough to suggest he'd just bathed, which was a horrible thing to think about as she stood beside his chair, because she was a professional healer, and imagining her patients naked was not a...
Aren't you going to ask what happened?
The prince said, peering up at her.
It's not my place to ask, and unless it's relevant to the injury, it's nothing I need to know.
It came out colder, harder than she meant, but it was true. Efficiently, she patched up his hand. The silence didn't bother her. She'd sometimes spent days in the catacombs without speaking to anyone. She'd been a quiet child before her parents had died, and after the massacre in the city square, she'd become even more so. It wasn't until she'd come to the castle that she found friends, found that she sometimes liked talking. Yet now, with him, well, it seemed that the prince didn't like silence, because he looked up at her again and said,
"Where are you from?"
Such a tricky question to answer, since the how and why of her journey to this castle were stained by the actions of his father.
"Fenharrow?"
she said, praying that would be the end of it.
"Where in Fenharrow?"
She almost cringed, but she had more self-control than that after 5 years of tending gruesome injuries and knowing that one flicker of disgust or fear on her face could shatter a patient's control.
a small village in the south. Most people have never heard of it.
Fenharrow is beautiful, he said. All that open land, stretching on forever.
She did not remember enough of it to recall whether she had loved the flat expanse of farmland, bordered on the west by mountains and on the east by sea.
Did you always want to be a healer?
Yes, she said.
Because she was entrusted to heal the heir to the Empire and could show nothing but absolute certainty. A slash of a grin.
Liar.
She didn't mean to, but she met his gaze. Those sapphire eyes so bright in the late afternoon sun streaming through the small window.
I did not mean any offense, your...
I'm prying.
He tested the bandages.
I was trying to distract myself.
She nodded, because she had nothing to say and could never come up with anything clever anyway.
She drew out her tin of disinfecting salve. For your lip, if you don't mind, Your Highness. I want to make sure there's no dirt or anything in the wound so it...
Sorsha.
She tried not to let it show. What it did to her to have him remember her name, or to hear him say it.
Do what you need to do.
She bit her lip, a stupid, nervous habit, and nodded as she tilted his chin up so she could better see his mouth. His skin was so warm. She touched the wound and he hissed, his breath caressing her fingers, but didn't pull back or reprimand or strike her, as some of the other courtiers did. She applied the salve to his lip as quickly as she could. Gods, his lips were soft. She hadn't known he was the prince the day she first saw him, striding through the gardens, the captain in tow. They were barely into their teenage years, and she was an apprentice in hand-me-down clothes. But for a moment, he'd looked at her and smiled. He'd seen her when no one else had for years. So she found excuses to be in the upper levels of the castle. But she'd wept the next month when she spied him again. And two apprentices had whispered about how handsome the prince was. Dorian, heir to the throne. It had been secret and stupid, this infatuation with him. Because when she finally encountered him again, years later while helping Amethy with a patient, he did not look at her. She had become invisible, like many of the healers. Invisible, just as she had wanted.
Sorsha?
Her horror achieved new depths as she realized she'd been staring at his mouth, fingers still in her tin of salve.
I'm sorry, she said,
wondering whether she should throw herself from the tower and end her humiliation.
It's been a long day.
That wasn't a lie. She was acting like a fool. She'd been with a man before, one of the guards. Just once, and long enough to know she wasn't particularly interested in letting another one touch her anytime soon. But standing so close, his legs brushing the skirt of her brown homespun dress.
Why didn't you tell anyone?
He asked quietly.
About me and my friends.
She backed away a step, but held his stare, even though training and instinct told her to avert her eyes.
You were never cruel to the healers. To anyone. I like to think that the world needs...
Saying that was too much, because the world was his father's world.
Needs better people,
he finished for her, standing. And you think my father would have used your knowledge of our comings and goings against us? So he knew that Amethy reported anything unusual. Amethy had told Sorsha to do the same, if she knew what was good for her.
I don't mean to imply that His Majesty would...
Does your village still exist?
Are your parents still alive?
Even years later, she couldn't keep the pain from her voice as she said, "No, it was burned. And no, they brought me to Rifthold, and were killed in the city's immigrant perch."
A shadow of grief and horror in his eyes.
"So why would you ever come here? Work here?"
She gathered her supplies. "Because I had nowhere else to go."
Agony flickered on his face.
"Your Highness, have I..."
But he was staring as if he understood. And saw her.
"I'm sorry."
"It wasn't your decision, or your soldiers who rounded up my parents."
He only looked at her for a long moment before thanking her. A polite dismissal. And she wished, as she left that cluttered tower, that she'd never opened her mouth, because perhaps he'd never call on her again for the sheer awkwardness of it. She wouldn't lose her position, because he wasn't that cruel. But if he refused her services, then it might lead to questions. So Sorsha resolved, as she lay that night in her little cot, to find a way to apologize, or maybe find excuses to keep the prince from seeing her again. Tomorrow. She'd figure it out tomorrow. The following day, she didn't expect the messenger who arrived after breakfast, asking for the name of her village. And when she hesitated, he said that the crown prince wanted to know. Wanted to know, so he could have it added to his personal map of the continent.
Chapter 16.
Of all the spaces in the Omega, the mess hall was by far the most dangerous. The three Iron Teeth clans had been divided into rotating shifts that kept them mostly separated. Training with the Wyverns, training in the weapons room, and training in mortal warfare. It was smart to separate them, Manon supposed, since tensions were high, and would continue to run high until the Wyverns were selected. Everyone wanted a bull. Though Manon fully expected to get one, perhaps even Titus, it didn't keep her from wanting to punch out the teeth of anyone who even whispered about coveting a bull of her own. There were only a few overlapping minutes between their 3-hour rotations, and the coven leaders did their best to keep them from running into each other. At least Manon did. Her temper was on a tight leash these days, and one more sneer from the Yellowleg's heir was likely to end in bloodshed. The same could be said of her 13, two of whom, the green-eyed twins Faelene and Fallon, more demon than witch, had gotten into a brawl with some Yellowleg's idiots, unsurprisingly. She'd punished them just as she'd punished Asterin, 3 blows each, public and humiliating. But like clockwork, fights still broke out between other covens when they were in close quarters, which was what made the mess hall so deadly. The 2 daily meals were the only time they all shared together, and while they kept to their own tables, the tension was so thick Manon could slice it with her blade. Manon stood in line for her bowl of slop. That was the best name she could give the doughy goop the mess hall served, flanked by Asterin, with the last of the Blue Blood witches in the line ahead of her. Somehow, the Blue Bloods were always first. First in line for food, first to ride the Wyverns, the 13 had yet to get airborne, and likely to get first pick of the beasts. A growl rumbled deep in her throat, but Manon pushed her tray along the table, watching the pale-faced server heap a grayish-white ball of food into the bowl of the Blue Blood in front of her. She didn't bother to note the details of his features as the thick vein in his throat pulsed. Witches didn't need blood to survive, but humans didn't need wine either. The Blue Bloods were picky about whose blood they drank. Virgins, young men, pretty girls. But the Blackbeaks didn't particularly care one way or another. The man's ladle began shaking, tip-tapping along the side of the cauldron.
"Rules are rules," drawled a voice to her left.
Asterin let out a warning snarl, and Manon didn't have to look to know that the Yellowleg's heir, Iskra, lurked there.
No eating the rabble,
the dark-haired witch added, shoving her bowl in front of the man, cutting the line. Manon took in the iron nails and teeth, the calloused hand so blatantly making a show of dominance.
Ah, I was wondering why no one's bothered to eat you, Manon said.
Iskra shouldered her way farther in front of Manon. Manon could feel the eyes in the room shifting toward them, but she reined in her temper, allowing the disrespect. Mess hall posturing meant nothing.
I hear your 13 are taken to the air today, said the Yellowleg's heir, as Manon received her own ration.
What business is it of yours?
Iskra shrugged her toned shoulders. They say you were once the best flyer in all three clans. It would be a shame if it were just more gossip.
It was true. She'd earned her spot as coven leader as much as she'd inherited it. Iskra went on, sliding her plate along to the next server, who spooned some pale root vegetable onto her slop.
There's talk of skipping our training rotation, so we can see the legendary 13 take to the skies for the first time in a decade.
Manon clicked her tongue in pretend thought.
I also heard there's talk that the Yellowlegs need all the help they can get in the sparring room. But I suppose any army needs its supply drivers.
A low laugh from Asterin, and Iskra's brown eyes flashed. They reached the end of the serving table, where Iskra faced Manon. With their trays in hand, neither could reach for the blades at their sides. The room had gone silent. Even the high table at which the three matrons sat. Manon's gums stung, as her iron teeth shot from their slits and snapped down. She said quietly, but loud enough for everyone to hear,
Any time you need a lesson in combat, Iskra, you just let me know. I'd be happy to teach you a few things about soldiering.
Before the heir could reply, Manon stalked across the room. Asterin gave Iskra a mocking bow of the head, followed by identical gestures from the rest of her 13. But Iskra remained staring at Manon, simmering. Manon plunked down at her table to find her grandmother smiling faintly. And when all of Manon's 12 sentinels were seated around her, 13 from now until the darkness embraced them, Manon allowed herself a smile, too. They were going to fly today. As if the open cliff face weren't enough to make the two gathered Blackbeak covens shift on their feet, the 26 tethered wyverns in a tight space, none of them that docile, made even Manon twitchy. But she showed no fear as she approached the wyvern at the center. Two lines of 13 stood chained and ready. The 13 took the first. The other coven took the one behind. Manon's new riding gear was heavy and awkward. Leather and fur, capped with steel shoulder guards and leather wrist braces. More than she was used to wearing, especially with her red cloak. They'd already practiced saddling the mounts for 2 days, though they'd usually have handlers around to do it for them. Manon's mount for the day, a small female, was lying on her belly, low enough that Manon easily climbed her hind leg and hauled herself into the saddle at the spot where the long neck met the massive shoulders. A man approached to adjust the stirrups, but Manon leaned to do it herself. Breakfast had been bad enough. Coming close to a human throat now would only tempt her further. The wyvern shifted, its body warm against her cold legs, and Manon tightened her gloved grip on the reins. Down the line, her sentinels mounted their beasts. Asterin was ready, of course, her cousin's gold hair tightly braided back, her fur collar ruffling in the biting wind from the open drop ahead of them. She flashed Manon a grin,
her dark, gold-flecked eyes bright. Not a trace of fear, just the thrill. The beasts knew what to do, the handlers had said. They knew how to make the crossing on instinct alone. That's what they called the sheer plunge between the two mountain peaks, the final test for a rider and mount. If the wyverns couldn't make it, they'd splatter on the rocks far below, with their riders. There was movement on the viewing platforms on either side, and the Yellowlegs' heirs' coven swaggered in, all of them smiling, none more broadly than Iskra.
"Bitch," Asterin murmured,
as if it weren't bad enough that Mother Blackbeak stood on the opposite viewing platform, flanked by the other two high witches. Manon lifted her chin and looked to the drop ahead.
"Just like we practiced," the overseer said, climbing from the open-faced pit to the viewing platform where the three matrons stood. "Hard kick in the side sends him off. Let him navigate the crossing. Best advice is to hold on like hell and enjoy the ride."
A few nervous laughs from the coven behind her, but the 13 remained silent, waiting, just as they would faced with any army, before any battle. Manon blinked, the muscles behind her golden eyes pulling down the clear film that would shield her vision from the wind. Manon allowed herself a moment to adjust to the thickness of the extra lid. Without it, they'd fly like mortals, squinting and streaming tears all over the place.
"Ready at your command, lady,"
the man called to her. Manon studied the open gap ahead, the bridge barely visible above, the gray skies and mist. She looked down the line, into each of the six faces on either side. Then she turned ahead, to the drop and the world waiting beyond.
"We are the 13, from now until the darkness claims us."
She said it quietly, but knew all could hear her.
"Let's remind them why."
Manon kicked her mount into action. Three galloping, thunderous steps beneath her, surging forward, 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 a leap into freezing air, the clouds and the bridge and the snow all around, and then the drop. Her stomach shot right into her throat as the wyvern arced and angled down, wings tucked in tight. As she'd been instructed, Manon rose into a crouch over the neck, keeping her face close to the leathery skin, the wind screaming in her face. The air rippled behind her, her 13 mere feet away, falling as one, past rock and snow, shooting for the earth. Manon gritted her teeth. The blur of stone, the kiss of mist, her hair ripping out of her braid, waving like a white banner above her. The mist parted, and darkness embraced her. There was the gap floor, so close, and Manon held on to the saddle, to the reins, to conscious thought as massive wings spread and the world tilted, and the body beneath her flipped up, up, riding the wind's current in a sheer climb along the side of the northern fang. There were triumphant howls from below, from above, and the wyvern kept climbing, swifter than Manon had ever flown on her broom, past the bridge and up into the open sky. That fast, Manon was back in the skies. The cloudless, endless, eternal sky held them as Asterin, and then Sorrel and Vesta flanked her, then the rest of the 13. And Manon schooled her face into cool victory. To her right, Asterin was beaming, her iron teeth shining like silver. To her left, red-haired Vesta was just shaking her head, gaping at the mountains below. Sorrel was as stone-faced as Manon, but her black eyes danced. The 13 were airborne again. The world spread beneath them, and ahead, far to the west, was the home they would someday reclaim. But now, the wind caressed and sang to her, telling her of its currents, more an instinct than a magical gift. An instinct that had made her the best flyer in all three clans. "What now?" Asterin called. And although she'd never seen any of her 13 cry, Manon could have sworn there were tears shining in the corners of her cousin's eyes. "I say, we test them out," Manon said, keeping that wild exuberance locked up tight in her chest, and reined her mount toward where the first canyon run awaited them. The whoops and cackles of her 13 as they rode the current were finer than any mortal music. Manon stood at attention in her grandmother's small room, staring at the far stone wall until she was spoken to. Mother Blackbeak sat at the wooden desk, her back to Manon as she pored over some document or letter. "You did well today, Manon," her grandmother said at last. Manon touched two fingers to her brow, though her grandmother still studied the papers. Manon hadn't needed to be told by the overseer that it was the best crossing he had witnessed to date. She'd taken one look at the empty platform where the Yellowlegs' coven had been, and known they'd left as soon as Manon didn't splatter on the ground. "You're 13 and all the Blackbeak covens did well," her grandmother went on. "Your work in keeping them disciplined these years is commendable." Manon's chest swelled, but she said, "It's my honor to serve you, grandmother." Her grandmother scribbled something down. "I want you and the 13 to be wing leader. I want you leading all the clans." The witch twisted to look at Manon, her face unreadable. "There are to be war games in a few months to decide the ranks. I don't care how you do it, but I expect to crown you victor." Manon didn't need to ask why. Her grandmother's eyes fell on Manon's red cloak as she smiled faintly. "We don't yet know who our enemies will be. But once we are done with the King's War and reclaim the Wastes, it will not be a Blueblood or Yellowlegs sitting on the Iron Teeth throne. Understand? Become wing leader, command the Iron Teeth armies, and keep control of those armies once the matrons eventually turned on one another." Manon nodded. It would be done. "I suspect the other matrons will give similar orders to their heirs. Make sure your second keeps close to you." Asterin was already outside, guarding the door, but Manon said, "I can look after myself." Her grandmother hissed. "Baba Yellowlegs was 700 years old. She tore down the walls of the Kraken capital with her bare hands. And yet someone slipped into her wagon and murdered her. Even if you live to be 1,000, you'll be lucky to be half the witch she was." Manon kept her chin high. "Watch your back. I will not be pleased if I have to find myself another heir." Manon bowed her head. "As you will it, grandmother." Chapter 17. Selena awoke, freezing and groaning from a relentless headache. That, she knew, was from hitting her head on the temple stones. She hissed as she sat up. And every inch of her body, from her ears to her toes to her teeth, gave a collective burst of pain. It felt as if she'd been pummeled by 1,000 iron fists and left to rot in the cold. That was from the uncontrolled shifting she'd done yesterday. The gods knew how many times she'd shuddered between one form and the other. From the tenderness of her muscles, it had to have been dozens. But she hadn't lost control of the magic, she reminded herself as she rose, gripping the chipped bedpost. She pulled the pale robe tighter around her as she shuffled for the dresser and basin. After the bath, she realized she had nothing to change into and had stolen one of the many robes, leaving her reeking clothes heaped by the door. She'd barely made it to her room before she collapsed on the bed, pulled the scrap of blanket over her, and slept. And slept, and slept. She didn't feel like talking with anyone, and no one came for her anyway. Selena braced her hands on the dresser and grimaced at her reflection. She looked like shit, felt like shit, even more grim and gaunt than yesterday. She picked up the tin of salve Rowan had given her, but then decided he should see what he'd done. And she'd looked worse. 2 years ago, when Arobin had beaten her to a bloody pulp for disobeying his orders, this was nothing compared to how mangled she'd been then. She opened the door to find that someone had left clothes, the same as yesterday, but fresh. Her boots had been cleaned of mud and dust. Either Rowan had left them, or someone else had noticed her filthy clothing. Gods, she'd soiled herself in front of him. She didn't let herself wallow in the humiliation as she dressed and went to the kitchens, the halls dark in the moments before dawn. Already, Luca was prattling about the fighting knife a sentry had loaned him for his training, and on and on and on. Apparently she had underestimated how horrific her face was, because Luca stopped his chattering mid-sentence to swear. Whirling, Emrys took one look at her and dropped his earthenware bowl before the hearth. Great mother and all her children. Selena went to the heap of garlic cloves on the work table and picked up a knife. It looks worse than it feels. A lie. Her head was still pounding from the cut on her brow, and her eye was deeply bruised beneath. I've got some salve in my room. Luca started from where he was already washing dishes, but she gave him a long look. She began peeling the cloves, her fingers instantly sticky. They were still staring, so she flatly said, It's none of your business. Emrys left his shattered bowl on the hearthstones and hobbled over, anger dancing in those bright, clever eyes. It's my business when you come into my kitchen. I've been through worse, she said. Luca said, What do you mean? He eyed her mangled hands, her black eye, and the ring of scars around her neck, courtesy of Baba Yellow Legs. She silently invited him to do the calculations. A life in Otterlin with Fey blood. A life in Otterlin as a woman. His face paled. After a long moment, Emrys said, Leave it alone, Luca. And stooped to pick up the fragments of the bowl. Selena went back to the garlic, Luca markedly quieter as he worked. Breakfast was made and sent upstairs in the same chaotic rush as yesterday, but a few more demi-fae noticed her today. She either ignored them or stared them down, marking their faces. Many had pointed ears, but most seemed human. Some wore civilian clothing, tunics and simple gowns, while the sentries wore light leather armor and heavy gray cloaks with an array of weapons, many the worse for wear. The warriors looked her way the most, men and women both, wariness and curiosity mingling. She was busy wiping down a copper pot when someone let out a low, appreciative whistle in her direction. Now that is one of the most glorious black eyes I've ever beheld. A tall old man, handsome despite being around Emrys's age, strode through the kitchen, empty platter in his hands. You leave her be too, Malachi, Emrys said from the hearth. His husband, mate. The old man gave a dashing grin and set down the platter on the counter near Selena. Rowan doesn't pull punches, does he? His gray hair was cropped short enough to reveal his pointed ears, but his face was ruggedly human. And it looks like you don't bother using a healing salve. She held his gaze, but gave no reply. Malachi's grin faded. My mate works too much as it is. You don't add to that burden, understand? Emrys growled his name, but Selena shrugged. I don't want to bother with any of you. Malachi caught the unspoken warning in her words, so don't try to bother with me, and gave her a curt nod. She heard, more than saw, him stride to Emrys and kiss him, then the rumble of some murmured, stern words, and then his steady footsteps as he walked out again. Even the demi-fey warrior males push overprotective to a whole new level, Emrys said, the words laced with forced lightness. It's in our blood, Luca said, lifting his chin. It is our duty, honor, and life's mission to make sure our families are cared for, especially our mates. And it makes you a thorn in our side, Emrys clucked. Possessive territorial beasts. The old man strode to the sink, setting down the cool kettle for Selena to wash. My mate means well, lass, but you're a stranger, and from Otterlin, and you're training with someone none of us quite understand. Selena dumped the kettle in the sink. I don't care, she said, and meant it. Training was horrible that day. Not just because Rowan asked if she was going to vomit or piss herself again, but also because for hours, he made her sit amongst the temple ruins on the ridge, battered by the misty wind. He wanted her to shift. That was his only command. She demanded to know why he couldn't teach her the magic without shifting, and he gave her the same answer again and again. No shift, no magic lessons. But after yesterday, nothing short of him taking his long dagger and cutting her ears into points would get her to change forms. She tried once, when he stalked into the woods for some privacy. She tugged and yanked and pulled at whatever lay deep inside her, but got nothing. No flash of light or searing pain. So they sat on the mountainside, Selena frozen to the bone. At least she didn't lose control again, no matter what insults he threw her way, either aloud or through one of their silent, vicious conversations. She asked him why he wasn't pursuing the creature that had been in the Barrow-Whites field, and he merely said that he was looking into it, and the rest was none of her concern. Thunderclouds clustered during the late afternoon. Rowan forced her to sit through the storm until her teeth were clattering in her skull, and her blood was thick with ice. And then they finally made the trek to the fortress. He ditched her by the baths again, eyes glimmering with an unspoken promise that tomorrow would be worse. When she finally emerged, there were dry clothes in her room, folded and placed with such care that she was starting to wonder whether she didn't have some invisible servant shadowing her. There was no way in hell an immortal like Rowan would have bothered to do that for a human. She debated staying in her rooms for the rest of the night, especially as rain lashed at her window, lightning illuminating the trees beyond. But her stomach gurgled. She was lightheaded again, and knew she'd been eating like an idiot. With her black eye, the best thing to do was eat, even if it meant going to the kitchens. She waited until she thought everyone had gone upstairs. There were always leftovers after breakfast. There had to be some at dinner. Gods, she was bone-tired, and ached even worse than she had this morning. She heard the voices long before she entered the kitchen, and almost turned back, but no one had spoken to her at breakfast save Malachi. Surely everyone would ignore her now, too. She'd estimated a good number of people in the kitchen, but was still a bit surprised by how packed it was.
Chairs and cushions had been dragged in, all facing the hearth, before which Emrys and Malachi sat, chatting with those gathered. There was food on every surface, as if dinner had been held in here. Keeping to the shadows atop the stairs, she observed them. The dining hall was spacious, if a bit cold. Why gather around the kitchen hearth? She didn't particularly care, not when she saw the food. She slipped in through the gathered crowd with practiced stealth and ease, filling up a plate with roast chicken, potatoes, gods, she was already sick of potatoes, and hot bread. Everyone was still chatting. Those who didn't have seats were standing against the counters or walls, laughing and sipping from their mugs of ale. The upper half of the kitchen door was open to let out the heat from all the bodies, the sound of rain filling the room like a drum. She caught a glimmer of movement outside, but when she looked, there was nothing there. Selena was about to slip back up the stairs when Malachi clapped his hands and everyone stopped talking. Selena paused again in the shadows of the stairwell. Smiles spread, and people settled in. Seated on the floor in front of Emrys's chair was Luca, a pretty young woman pressed into his side, his arm casually draped around her shoulders. Casually, but with enough of a grip to tell every other male in the room that she was his. Selena rolled her eyes, not at all surprised. Still, she caught the look Luca gave the girl, the mischief in his eyes that sent a pang of jealousy right through her. She'd looked at Kaol with that same expression. But their relationship had never been as unburdened, and even if she hadn't ended things, it never would have been like that. The ring on her finger became a weight. Lightning flashed, revealing the grass and forest beyond. Seconds later, thunder shook the stones, triggering a few shrieks and laughs. Emrys cleared his throat, and every eye snapped to his lined face. The ancient hearth illuminated his silver hair, casting shadows throughout the room. "Long ago," Emrys began, his voice weaving between the drumming rain and grumbling thunder and crackling fire. "When there was no mortal king on Wendland's throne, the Faeries still walked among us. Some were good and fair, some were prone to little mischiefs, and some were fouler and darker than the blackest night." Selena swallowed. These were words that had been spoken in front of hearths for thousands of years, spoken in kitchens like this one. Tradition. "It was those wicked Faeries," Emrys went on, the words resonating in every crack and crevice, "that you always had to watch for on the ancient roads, or in the woods, or on nights like this, when you can hear the wind moaning your name." "Oh, not that one," Luca groaned, but it wasn't heartfelt. Some of the others laughed, a bit nervously even. Someone else protested, "I won't sleep for a week." Selena leaned against the stone wall, shoveling food down her throat as the old man wove his tale. The hair on her neck stood on end for the duration of it, and she could see every horrific moment of the story as clearly as if she had lived it. As Emrys finished his tale, thunder boomed, and even Selena flinched, almost upsetting her empty plate. There were some wary laughs, some taunts and gentle pushes. Selena frowned. If she'd heard this story, with the wretched creatures who delighted in skin-sewing and bone-crunching and lightning-crisping, before traveling here with Rowan, she never would have followed him. Not in a million years. Rowan hadn't lit a single fire on the journey here. Hadn't wanted to attract attention. From these sorts of creatures? He hadn't known what that thing was the day before in the Barrows.
and if an immortal didn't know. She used breathing exercises to calm her pounding heart. Still, she'd be lucky if she slept tonight. Though everyone else seemed to be waiting for the next story, Selena stood. As she turned to leave, she looked again to that half-open kitchen door, just to make sure there was nothing lurking outside. But it was not some fell creature who waited in the rain. A large white-tailed hawk was perched in the shadows. It sat absolutely still. But the hawk's eyes, there was something strange about them. She'd seen that hawk before. It had watched her for days as she'd lazed on that rooftop in Verez, watched her drink and steal and doze and brawl. At least she now knew what Rowan's animal form was. What she didn't know was why he bothered to listen to these stories. Elentia. Emrys was extending a hand from where he sat before the hearth. Would you perhaps share a story from your lands? We'd love to hear a tale, if you'd do us the honor. Selena kept her eyes on the old man, as everyone turned to where she stood in the shadows. Not one of them offered a word of encouragement, save for Luca, who said, "Tell us!" But she had no right to tell those stories as if they were her own, and she could not remember them correctly, not as they had been told at her bedside. She clamped down on the thought as hard as she could, shoving it back long enough to calmly say, "No, thank you," and walk away. No one came after her. She didn't give a damn what Rowan made of the whole thing. The whispers died with each step, and it wasn't until she'd shut the door to her freezing room and slid into bed that she loosed a sigh. The rain stopped. The clouds cleared on a brisk wind. And through the window, a patch of stars flickered above the tree line. She had no stories to tell. All the legends of Terrasen were lost to her, and only fragments were strewn through her memories like rubble. She pulled her scrap of blanket higher and draped an arm over her eyes, shutting out the ever-watching stars. Chapter 18. Mercifully, Dorian wasn't forced to entertain Adian again, and saw little of him outside of state dinners and meetings, where the general pretended he didn't exist. He saw little of Kaol, too, which was a relief, given how awkward their conversations had been of late. But he'd begun to spar with the guards in the mornings. It was about as fun as laying on a bed of hot nails, but at least it gave him something to do with the restless, anxious energy that hounded him day and night. Not to mention, all those cuts and scrapes and sprains gave him an excuse to go to the healer's catacombs. Sorsha, it seemed, had caught on to his training schedule, and her door was always open when he arrived. He hadn't been able to stop thinking about what she'd said in his room, or wondering why someone who had lost everything would dedicate her life to helping the family of the man who had taken it all away. And when she'd said, "Because I had nowhere else to go," for a second, it hadn't been Sorsha but Selena, broken with grief and loss and rage, coming to his room because there was no one else to turn to. He'd never known what that was like, that loss. But Sorsha's kindness to him, which he'd repaid so foully until now, hit him like a stone to the head. Dorian entered her workroom, and Sorsha looked up from the table and smiled, broadly and prettily, and, well, wasn't that exactly the reason he found excuses to come here every day? He held up his wrist, already stiff and throbbing.
"Landed on it badly,"
he said by way of greeting. She came around the table, giving him enough time to admire the long lines of her figure in her simple gown. She moved like water, he thought,
and often caught himself marveling at the way she used her hands.
"There's not much I can do for that,"
she said after examining his wrist.
"But I have a tonic for the pain, only to subdue it, and I can put your arm in a sling if..."
"Gods, no. No sling. I'll never hear the end of it from the guards." Her eyes twinkled, just a bit, in that way they did when she was amused and tried hard not to be. But if there was no sling, then he had no excuse to be here. And even though he had an inane council meeting in an hour and still needed to bathe, he stood. "What are you working on?" She took a careful step back from him. She always did that, to keep the wall up.
"Well, I have a few tonics and salves to make for some of the servants and guards today, to replenish their stocks."
He knew he shouldn't, but he moved to peer over her narrow shoulder at the work table, at the bowls and vials and beakers. She made a small noise in her throat, and he swallowed his smile as he leaned a bit closer.
"This is normally a task for apprentices, but they were so busy today that I offered to take some of their workload."
She usually talked like this when she was nervous, which Dorian had noticed with some satisfaction, was when he came near. And not in a bad way. If he'd sensed that she was truly uncomfortable, he'd have kept his distance. This was more flustered. He liked flustered.
"But," she went on, trying to sidestep away, "I'll make your tonic right now, Your Highness."
He gave her the space she needed as she hurried about the table with graceful efficiency, measuring powders and crushing dried leaves, so steady and self-assured. He realized he'd been staring when she spoke again.
"Your friend, the King's Champion, is she well?"
Her mission to Wendland was fairly secret, but he could get around that. "She's off on my father's errand for the next few months. I certainly hope she's well, though I have no doubt she can care for herself."
"And her hound? She's well?"
"Fleetfoot? Oh, she's fine. Her legs healed beautifully." The hound now slept in his bed, of course, and bullied him for scraps and treats to no end. But it was nice to have some piece of his friend while she was gone.
"Thanks to you."
A nod. And silence fell as she measured and then poured some green-looking liquid. He sincerely hoped he wasn't going to drink that.
"They said..."
Sorsha kept her spectacular eyes down.
"They said there was some wild animal roaming the halls a few months ago. That's what killed all those people before Yulmas. I never heard whether they caught it, but then... your friend's dog looked like she'd been attacked."
Dorian willed himself to keep still. She'd truly put some things together then, and hadn't told anyone.
"Ask it, Sorsha."
Her throat bobbed, and her hands shook a little, enough that he wanted to reach out and cover them. But he couldn't move. Not until she spoke.
"What was it?"
she breathed.
"Do you want the answer that will keep you asleep at night? Or the one that might ensure you never sleep again?"
She lifted her gaze to him, and he knew she wanted the truth. So he loosed a breath and said,
"It was two different creatures. My father's champion dealt with the first. She didn't even tell the captain and me until we faced the second."
He could still hear that creature's roar in the tunnel, still see it squaring off against Kaol. Still had nightmares about it.
"The rest is a bit of a mystery."
It wasn't a lie. There was still so much he didn't know and didn't want to learn.
"Would His Majesty punish you for it?"
A quiet, dangerous question.
Yes.
His blood chilled.